through all the years till the end of time. Love me tender, love me true, all my dreams fulfill. For my darling, I love you, and I always will.
It's not often we get a welcome from Elvis as we arrive in church. You're welcome, everybody here is welcome. You're welcome whether you're looking on the website later on, whether you're on the webcam, and of course, if you are here and if you come from afar. My name is Paul Murray, and it's my turn to take the service when Bridget is taking a break. And it's important to stress that anything said in this pulpit is the personal view of the person who's leading the service. We have no creed, and we are free to believe exactly what we like. In Unitarian churches around the world, a chalice is lit as a beacon of hope, as a sign of our search for truth and meaning, and as a sign of our communion with each other. Let us this morning think of the many people all over the world who are enduring a lack of or a loss of an intimate life. People who, for multifarious reasons, who, if they desire a loving and or sexual relationship, and of course not everybody does, deny themselves or are denied a wondrous joy given by their Creator. Too often, perhaps, religious organizations have failed to succor those who are isolated in this way and ignore how sexual activity can help make us truly human and indeed more spiritual. Let us be aware of what, for many people, although not all, may be a deep sorrow as they are daily reminded through media messages, the public affections of the young, the pairing off of those close to them, and the sound of wedding bells, that they are on the outside looking in. Let us think deeply of how we could be supportive, and we all have to support each other in many ways, without intruding on their personal privacy. Our first hymn, Spirit of Life, number 123. Our reader today is Frank Kelly. I'll be Frank Kelly. This is from Mary Oliver. When death comes like the hungry bear in autumn, when death comes and takes all the bright coins from his purse to buy me and snaps the purse shut, when death comes like the measles pox, when death comes like an iceberg between the shoulder blades, I want to step through the door full of curiosity, wondering what it is like to be like that cottage of darkness. And therefore, I look upon everything as a brotherhood and a sisterhood. And I look upon time as no more than an idea. And I consider eternity as another possibility. And I think of each life as a flower, as common as a field daisy, and as singular, and each name a comfortable music in the mouth, tending, as all music does, towards silence. And each body a line of courage and something precious for to the earth. When it's over, I want to say, all my life I was a bride married to amazement. I was the bridegroom taking the world in my arms. When it's over, I don't want to wonder if I have made of my life something particular and real. I don't want to find myself sighing and frightened or full of argument. I don't want to end up simply having visited the world. Mary Oliver. If we now say the back of the book, love is the doctrine of this church. Love is the doctrine of this church. The quest of truth is its sacrament, and service is its prayer. To dwell together in peace, to seek knowledge and freedom, to serve mankind in fellowship and all in harmony with the divine. This do we covenant with each other and with God. Our next hymn is Bring Many Names, and it's number 23. Now, this story is about a boy and a girl. And the boy was called Turlough. And he was called Turlough because his father was an Irish-American who wanted a strong name for his boy. And the girl was called Ansie. And she was called Ansie because her parents didn't want her to have a Catholic kind of name. So Ansie and Turlough used to play mud pies in Dundrum together many, many years ago. And they got on very well, but then after a little while, as happens with all friendships, they drifted apart that little as they became teenagers. And one of the reasons was because Turlough was one of the world's great achievers. He succeeded in absolutely everything. He was the first out on the road, having done his homework, while poor old Ansie would be inside for an hour and a half trying to understand algebra or something. He was outside playing, and he started the mud pies, as you can imagine. So life went on a bit, and Turlough became, as I said, very successful. He got gold medals in UCD, and he even played for Leinster, which has probably been the epitome of success in Dublin society. And he went to that school, you may know it, where they build rugby players from scratch. I think it was, it's why that area is called Balls Bridge, because the balls used to keep going over into the French embassy, and they used to get very upset. But anyway, he went there, and then, as I said, he became very successful. And he got all sorts of gold medals, and he joined that firm, you'll know it, a finance firm called Delighted and Touched, and was very successful there. And one of the reasons he was successful, of course, he had a huge advantage in that when he was in America, up to 5 years of age, before his daddy came home to Ireland with his wife, they had done assertiveness training in the creche. They thought it was very much part of the American dream that every kid should do assertiveness training. But meanwhile, poor old Ansie had a big problem. She was intelligent, but one difficulty she had was that she couldn't remember the first or the last letter of a word. Now you can imagine how difficult that was. And she couldn't get into When the time came, she couldn't get into an Irish university. Now, you may remember
Some of us remember that years ago there were only four universities, and there was the little one up in Belfast, and then if you wanted to do medicine, you could go next door. So now there's sort of a university for everybody in the audience, but she couldn't get into an Irish university. So her parents, who were very good parents, suggested to her that what she might do is go over to Britain, and she might learn, she might get into a university there. And she did. She scraped in, and she did a very interesting course, and the course was about something about hearing aids and sounds and aeroplane jet engines, that kind of thing. Quite a sophisticated course. Anyway, as the course went on, she found the kids over there, the students, very hard to understand, and their accents. And it turned out that the reason they had those kind of accents was because they lived in an area where they made trucks and lorries. Now, what happened is over the years, people were listening to the whine of the engines, and they picked up that in their accent. So she couldn't define it. She found it very difficult. But as often happens, she had a bit of luck. And the bit of luck was that she, in Ireland, had learned algebra. Now, you may remember, I remember, that they gave up algebra here some years ago, many years ago. But they had it longer than they had in Britain. So in Ireland, we were doing algebra, I think, 10 years longer than the British. So suddenly, people began to realize that this was a significant person in their midst, and they started asking her about algebra, and she began to be popular, and she began to understand the accents, and even they started to ask her out, boys and girls. Now, the next thing that happened was she did very well. She got a good degree, and she was able to come back to Ireland. And Turlough, meanwhile, as I said, was doing very, very well in his job and delighted and touched. And he, one day, anyway, Anzie had a habit. She had a good salary, but not enough to buy anything in Brown Thomas. But what she used to do once a week was go into Brown Thomas and get a whiff of the perfume in the perfume counter. She'd go, you know, she looked across anyway one day, and there she saw himself, Turlough. And he was in a very good tweed suit, but she got the impression, well, I know you're all romantics, and you'd love to think that this was the blossoming of a big romance. But she realized that Turlough was buying jewelry. Now, unlike most men, when they're buying jewelry for somebody they love, they would have a nice beatific vision on their faces while they're buying it, until they saw the credit card the next day. But they would have, you know, they'd be happy doing it. But poor Turlough looked pretty miserable. And it was then that Anzie realized that there was nothing doing here, and she didn't want there to be anything doing. And in her mind, she said goodbye to Turlough. She thought Turlough probably saw her. And she walked out and continued to live her life very happily. Now, the thing to ask at the end of the story, and Clara, you might like to tell me, what do you think the lesson of is it learn algebra? Or,
yes.
Okay. So if we were to have a lesson from the, it's the importance, and this is to all the kids in cyberspace, it's the importance of continuing to work hard even when the going gets tough. It's the importance of perhaps learning one or two things really well that might come in useful. And it's also important to remember that the people who have it easy, like Turlough, don't necessarily succeed in life. So thank you for coming up. You're very brave.
Sorry, that's... Now, our second reading. Mary Oliver. You do not have to be good. You do not have to walk on your knees for 100 miles through the desert, repenting. You only have to let the soft animal of your body love what it loves. Tell me about despair, yours, and I will tell you mine. Meanwhile, the world goes on. Meanwhile, the sun and the clear pebbles of the rain are moving across the landscapes, over the prairies and the deep trees, the mountains and the rivers. Meanwhile, the wild geese, high in the clear blue air, are heading home again. Whoever you are, no matter how lonely, the world offers itself to your imagination, calls to you like the wild geese, harsh and exciting, over and over announcing your place in the family of things. Mary Oliver. Let us reflect. Let us think about those who are lonely. Let us remember that not everybody finds life easy, that not everybody finds it easy to relate to other people, and that life is just a journey which can be extremely difficult for many people.
If you were the only girl in the world, and I were the only boy, nothing else would matter in the world today. We would go on loving in the same old way. A Garden of Eden just made for two, with nothing to mar. I would say such wonderful things to you. There would be such wonderful things to do if you were the only girl. And I were the only boy. A Garden of Eden just made for two, with nothing to mar our joy. I would say such wonderful things to you. There would be such wonderful things to do if you were the only girl in the world, and I were the only.
In Vilnius, the capital of Lithuania, in a particular art gallery, one of the most striking paintings is called The Prude. It depicts the side view of an elderly woman staring out a window, and in the background are religious artifacts. The painting is interesting because the woman is, as you could suggest, universal. She could be from Mullingar, Cork, Portlaoise, or Dublin. And she carries a view, and this is 1939, that there's an awful lot of stuff going on of which she doesn't approve. A striking thing about the gallery's art, and it's important to point this out, is that in this and another very good gallery, paintings, as you would expect, very much reflect the era in which they were created. And of course, there was the violent intrusion of the Nazis and later the Soviets. A picture of the two Graces, one of them naked, is from 1937. An oil painting from 1932 is of a clothes-free woman bathing. But as we move into the Nazi and Soviet periods, joyousness and joie de vivre is largely absent. We, for example, are presented with sturdy workers and the Red Army being cheered on as they march towards the conquering Latvia. Our discussion is, as indicated, about sex and the historical shifts in the content of art generally can perhaps be mirrored in how, over the decades, we as a society had dealt with sex, love, pleasure, and reproduction, and indeed, how our ethics surrounding these have altered. Our focus is on ethics. When you ask people who have lived many decades about our society, they will frequently say there is a drift, a lowering of sexual behavior standards, a lack of discipline, and that no ethic has emerged to replace that of the Christian churches, which are largely ignored, especially by the young. They will say there must be barriers, taboos to certain types of behavior, which of course is true, particularly in regard to protecting the young, and that the family of man, woman, and children is being weakened. It is perhaps time, and churches and the wider society have an obligation here, for us to be brave, to seriously debate how we can develop a new sexual ethic, an updated moral paradigm for how we go about our sexual activity. Many of us were brought up to believe that sexual pleasure was only allowed in marriage, and that one married an opposite gender partner who was loved, and then and only then the couple could set about the fun of making children, and of course would stay together until death did them part. But much of that scenario, as we know, is now crumbling. Women are much less likely to stay in intolerable relationships. There is divorce, and the way is open for gay marriage. A very substantial number of people live with their partners without marrying. In a few decades, really, everything changed. Even the Catholic Church eventually shifted its position which had stated that procreation was the primary purpose of marital sex, and that the expression and fostering of love between the couple was secondary. This previous stance was part of the attempt to deny that sexual pleasure was every man and woman's entitlement. To deny, as Wordsworth put it, that pleasure is the tribute we owe to our dignity as human beings. John O'Donoghue believed that this was a profoundly spiritual perspective. Your senses, he said, link you intimately with the divine within you and around you. The wonderful Mary Oliver, who we've read in Wild Geats, puts pleasure on, as has been described, a heavenly plane. She suggests that we must treat the soft animal of our bodies with kindness. We should allow ourselves to love what we love with feelings that need not always be held in check by rationality. Rather than fight it, we should celebrate and nurture our animal self. However, any attempt to civilize ourselves is often our greatest source of pain, she adds. The body-denying tradition of some branches of Christianity is lamented by Nancy Mayers. You would think, she says, wouldn't you, that a faith found on the premises of the reincarnation would hold in certain respect, perhaps in outright reverence, the body, the very form in which the divine elected to be housed. The world, she says, may well end if you cut down its trees and pave it over. It may well end if you permit its people to be unfed and unclothed and uneducated while you prosper. But the world will not end if you touch your genitals. The world will not end even if you touch someone else's genitals. I can think, she said, of sound reasons not to do so, but fear and disgust should not be among them. Your body is not a pest house, it is simply a body. Who you are, part of God's creation. A small part, true, but as real and lovely as the rest. If you love every part, evil will not enter the world through you. Luther, surprisingly to many perhaps, believed that lovemaking was not only sacred, but delightful. The best place, he said, to be at Christ's second coming was to be united in the act of making love. Through sex, according to Sally Tisdale, an essayist, we are partake of the one experience above all which allows us the bliss of true union. So, what is being intimated up to now is that the body itself and the joys that can ensue from it are to be celebrated, not to be imprisoned in musty religiosity. This is not to suggest that what Mary Oliver calls the soft animal within us should have carte blanche to run wild. Even the ancient Greeks, who had no concept of sex as sin, and for whom the craving for sexual pleasure was an accepted addiction, realized that the dangerous hunger for sex had to be kept in check. Which is why, for them, marriage was a necessity. Women were cloistered at home, often surrounded by guard dogs. After marriage, a main purpose of which was to produce a male heir, women and men often had little to do with each other. It was accepted, too, that men could be bisexual. And the Greeks were skeptical about love, which it was said made men copulate too often and lose their strength. the incessant physical longing of love was regarded as a disturbance of the body's natural balance, a disease which deprived the mind of its control of the body. The British philosopher A.C. Grayling, who I think died fairly recently, also looks at love with a cynical eye. He tells us that the first phase of what is termed love is a species of frenzy, which the Greeks feared as a punishment from God. And the second phase is a species of intermittent anesthesia, in which numbness makes almost bearable the anxious boredom of parents and the tensions, provocations, and annoyances of living squashed against another person year after year in a small space. He says that whatever name is best appropriate to the reason why a couple stick together through routines of domestic life, moving groceries and children about at frequent intervals, and watching too much TV, it isn't love. Grayling does say, however, that the mutual benefits of living in a committed relationship deserve celebration. But there is an exception, and that is where narrow, ignorant, and ungenerous views of what is accepted in human relationships exclude all but monogamous heterosexuals from the great good that human affections and shared lives offer. So far, we can perhaps agree that bodily pleasure is a good thing, even though there have been contrary voices, that views on the concept of love, as Grayling says, a short phase of sexual infatuation and a long phase of habit and inertia, can change, and that some boundaries are necessary to deal with Mary Oliver's soft animal of our bodies. The question is, what should these boundaries be? Where would we look for at least refreshed protocols for our sexual behavior? Protocols that would enhance humanity. Well, one lead could be from the young. Not because they thought it out. Largely, it seems, they have been led by their hormones. But chats with the psychologists, retired social workers, and people from other professional backgrounds and experience suggest that the young have indelibly decoupled love and sex. Of course, many older people have experienced sex without love, and many young people fall in love. But it is now as often expected that it is now not now as often expected that, like a horse and carriage, love and sex must go together. For many people, according to Richard Holloway, sex is an appetite to be satisfied with no necessary connection to any kind of relationship. Recreational sex, and he uses another word, is purely functional, pleasurable, and done for its own sake. And if it leads to sexual love and the development of a sexual relationship, a different code of ethics comes into play, requiring exclusivity as well as honesty about other sexual encounters. The emotional connection alters the ethical dynamic in a subtle way, creating a bond that opens each partner to the possibility of harm as a result of the conduct of the other. Any infidelity hurts and damages, and, says Holloway, is therefore wrong. With recreational sex, his thesis goes, there is no relationship to be broken. Now, traditionalists might say that it is wrong to treat sexuality with such triviality. And indeed, many of us may doubt that there is no bond to be broken. But Holloway directs us towards John Harris, who wrote the book Wonder Woman and Superman. Harris wrote, although it's hardly a new idea, that for a moral judgment to be respectable, it must have something to say about just why a supposed wrong action is wrongful. If it fails to meet this test, it is a preference and not a moral judgment. Holloway goes on to say that we may find the idea of recreational sex displeasing, but we ought to be careful about dismissing it as immoral. There is a definite need, he says, for a sense of balance in human sexuality, so that we do not constantly swing between the extremes of abnegation and overindulgence. And whatever guidelines are adopted will have to be applicable also to gay and lesbian people. This goes without saying, but it raises an important strand in establishing a reconsidered framework for sexual activity. Montaigne, who is often quoted, was willing to query what were seen as certainties and prejudices. We should, he said, do something we haven't done before. He was fascinated by change. He loved Ovid's Metamorphoses. People alter. They turn into trees, animals, stars, or disembodied bodies. And he wrote about what he saw as his own sexual inadequacies, his view seemingly being that he had communicated so much about himself. Why not the sexual part? So we should maybe be able to think of sex protocols in terms of change, as Montaigne might have done, all of which is against a background that monogamy is the official social norm in only 16% of human societies, and among 850 or so human societies recognized by anthropology, 83% practice polygamy. And another change that needs more understanding and an ethical basis, as does recreational sex, is sexual fluidity. In other words, how over a lifetime the sexual gender preferences of men and women can change. Sabra Katz Wise says that for many of us, changes in our lives are constant, yet it is a misconception that sexual orientation develops at an early age and remains stable throughout one's life. Changes in sexual orientation are a common thread in many people's lives, she says. This is distinct from bisexuality and can be experienced by people of any sexual orientation. ARP, a prominent US organization for people over 50, says that sexual orientation is not carved in stone. A great sadness in life for many people is how, through inertia, cultural background, age, or society's disapproval, they deny themselves or are denied an intimate partner, a partner who would fulfill many of their needs. They lose this opportunity because while a potential relationship may be loving in the widest sense, it would not be seen as what we traditionally regard as love. So perhaps as an antidote to loneliness, if nothing else, should we not encourage meaningful coupledom among men and women, men and men, women and women, even if Cupid misses the ultimate target of love? Should we not take into our ethical paradigm that sexual orientations are not immutable, and that love, the ideal, of course, and intimate alliances may, to misquote, alter when they alteration find. Indeed, should we not be discussing whether sex is a value in itself, needing boundaries and rules, of course, but an activity and appetite which can stand alone with minimal relationship requirements? A step too far for many, I think. So the suggestion is that we open our minds to new or less understood modes of sexuality and meld them within our ethical thinking. Ralph Helverson, who we've heard from in this church, says there is a persistent disposition to put people in pigeonholes, order them as they ought to be, and then get on with our business. We all have settled opinions that new ideas must confront. Some of these settled opinions are about sex ethics. It is perhaps time for fresh thinking, for inclusion in a revamped framework. Recreational sex, the separation of love and sexual activity, and fluidity. With many thanks. And any of the references, by the way, are on the text. We will now have the collection. Our notices, tea and coffee are served downstairs. Please, particularly if you're from elsewhere, please join us. Copies of the July Uskult are on the table. And then Pam's service of reflection is in the church and online on Wednesday from 1:05. And just to repeat this, if there is someone who might have a spare room, please, there's a lady who requires maintenance or special treatment. She flies back to Nashville on the 15th of September. So maybe contact Bridget if you know somebody who could give a spare room. The book club meets on the last Wednesday of the month at 7:30 via Zoom. And to thank everybody, to thank Kevin, of course, as always, Josh for the music, Paula for the flowers, and our coffee team of Michael, Paula, and Tony Shine. We're very grateful for all that you do. Our last hymn is My Life Flows On, an endless song, and it's page 108.
Let us go together from this sacred place, remembering that life is a journey with many fumbles and mistakes along the way, that perfection is rarely achieved, and that embracing change will enhance our chances of having a life well lived. And until we meet again, may God hold you in the palm of his hand. Amen.
Each time we have a quarrel, it almost breaks my heart, 'cause I'm so afraid that we will have to part. Each night I ask the stars up above, why must I be a teenager in love? One day I feel so happy, the next day I feel